This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Piede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Forest Service announced today its plans to begin logging in Oregon's largest inventoried roadless area.
The Striker Brigade in Washington State heads back to Iraq after a week of demonstrations that saw dozens arrested.
Last night, the BBC broadcast footage from an incident in March in which U.S. soldiers were accused of executing 11 Iraqis, including four children.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,474 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers, with many thousands wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports over 42,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 2nd, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. The Forest Service announced today plans to begin logging in Oregon's largest inventoried roadless area. This will be a first in the nation since a 2001 rule protected these unspoiled areas from logging. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has more.
At an auction in Medford next Friday, the Forest Service will sell approximately 335 acres of timber in an area affected by the 2002 Biscuit Fire. After the auction, logging could begin within days, and the land would be virtually clear-cut. There has already been a large amount of logging of Forest Service lands in the Biscuit Fire area. However, this would be the first roadless area to be logged.
Unfortunately, the aftermath of what's already happened down there is devastating.
That's Rolf Scar, campaign director at the Siskiyou Project.
There's been peer-reviewed published science about that logging that's shown that the logging increased fire risk, in other words, the risk of the forest re-burning, and has also devastated the natural regeneration that, of course, comes back after natural fires like Biscuit.
Scar says that since this is the first logging of a roadless area since the 2001 rule was approved, it would set a dangerous precedent nationwide.
Roadless forests are the crown jewels of our national forest system. They're where we get the best of our clean water, the recreation opportunities, and they're the true havens for wildlife and natural processes. So millions of Americans have weighed in on this issue over the years, time and time again. It's clear whether the Republican, Democrat, Independent, urban or rural, Americans want their roadless forests protected.
The 2001 roadless rule protected 58 million acres of national forest land from logging and other development. This rule enjoyed enormous public support.
More people wrote in support of that rule than any other federal rule in U.S. history on any topic, not just environmental issues.
But in May 2005, the Bush administration issued a new roadless policy. The new rule requires state governors to petition the federal government if they want roadless areas protected. The new rule puts control of federal forests in the hands of state governors, many of whom support logging in roadless areas. But now logging is slated to proceed in southern Oregon, despite the governor's opposition.
The Bush administration has asked state governors to petition them if they want to protect roadless forests in their state. While that process is going forward, they're supposed to not log roadless forests, which makes sense. You can't log before the outcome of that petition is evident. Well, our Governor Kulongowski is working on that petition right now, and the Bush administration is breaking their promise and charging ahead to log roadless forests while the governor is trying to work within the process that the Bush administration set up.
Scar says there is no scientific data to support the Bush administration's claim that logging will help the forests regenerate.
The easy way to understand it is, after a fire, forests are going through an enormous amount of change. They're in a very vulnerable state. Not that they won't recover on their own, but they don't have the resilience that they normally have when they're not recently affected by fire. So to lump industrial logging and then slash burning, hauling, and all that other stuff on top of a forest that's just had a fire is like it's like mugging a burn victim. It just makes no sense, and there's no ecological justification for it.
Just yesterday, the Siskiyou Project released a report which found that forests affected by the Biscuit Fire already show abundant regeneration.
We found that in a majority of the acres that they want to log in, there's more seedlings growing back than the Forest Service even requires replanting after logging. So, in other words, these areas are doing just fine on their own, and the Bush administration's claims that they're not growing back are simply hollow. They're not backed up by science, by on-the-ground evidence, or by common sense.
The Siskiyou Project is fighting in court against the Bush administration's new roadless rule and hopes to win an injunction against the logging. Meanwhile, the group plans to hold a vigil next Friday at the auction in Medford. For KBOO News, I'm Jacob Fenston.
Citing a risk to public safety, a federal magistrate judge has denied pretrial release for two environmental activists charged with sabotage and arson. Nathan Block and Joanna Zacher are two of 13 arrested in Operation Backfire, a sweeping federal investigation of multi-state sabotage and arson. The two are accused in two arsons in 2001. One was at a former truck dealership in Eugene, and the other at a tree farm in Clatskanie. U.S. Magistrate Judge Tom Coffin says evidence indicates the two support more violence because they think previous acts were ineffective. Both face a minimum of life plus 45 years in prison if convicted on all counts. Their defense attorney says the clients were not involved in all the counts against them. The 13 Backfire co-defendants are scheduled for trial October 31st in Eugene.
The city of Portland has completed its investigation into the sexual misconduct and abuse of power allegations against Police Chief Derek Foxworth. A report is scheduled to be presented to Mayor Tom Potter next week. Portland's Bureau of Human Resources told the Oregonian that Foxworth was interviewed three times during the investigation. His accuser, desk clerk Angela Oswald, was interviewed twice. Potter is expected to decide Foxworth's future by the middle of this month. Foxworth was placed on paid leave almost 2 months ago. Ms. Oswald's attorney filed a tort claim against the city that included sexually explicit emails Foxworth purportedly sent Oswald. According to the claim, Oswald and Foxworth had a sexual relationship before Foxworth was promoted to chief. Potter appointed Rosie Sizer to serve as acting chief.
The newest chapter of Oregon ACORN, that's the Association of Community Organization for Reform Now, has formed in the Park Rose District. The group's holding an event tonight aimed at improving public safety in Park Rose. The KBOO News reached organizer David Rigney on his cell phone today while he and other volunteers were setting up the event.
Well, tonight we're having a neighborhood cookout. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. at the 205 Auto Salvage. It's on 5605 Northeast 105th, about four blocks north of Sandy. And basically we're inviting neighborhood businesses, churches, community outreach groups to tackle some of the tough issues in Park Rose, the prostitution, the drugs, the gangs, because, you know, there's only so much that one group can do, but if we all band together, we might be able to accomplish more. But as many people as we can get out, that's great. We're in our infant stages. We're less than a month old.
That was David Rigby of ACORN. Tonight's neighborhood barbecue to begin organizing a campaign to improve public safety in Park Rose is at 6 o'clock this evening, right after the KBOO Evening News, at 205 Auto Salvage. That's at 5605 Northeast 105th Avenue, four blocks south of Sandy. For information on Oregon ACORN, call 503-788-4362 or go to oregon.acorn.org.
The U.S. Army held a deployment ceremony today at Fort Lewis, Washington, for its new Stryker Brigade. The brigade, formerly based in Georgia, is leaving this month for its second tour in Iraq. In the past week, the brigade's Strykers, the eight-wheeled armored vehicles, were loaded along with other equipment on a ship at Olympia. That drew anti-war demonstrators to the port. Approximately 36 people were pepper-sprayed over several days and or arrested before the ship left Wednesday night. At today's ceremony for the soldiers, friends, and relatives, the brigade commander said the soldiers are skilled warriors who treat the Iraqi people with dignity and respect. In their last deployment, 19 members of the Stryker Brigade were killed.
Texas will enlist web users in its fight against illegal immigration by offering live surveillance footage of the Mexican border on the Internet. The plan will allow web users worldwide to watch Texas' border with Mexico and phone the authorities if they spot any apparently illegal crossings. Texas Governor Rick Perry said the cameras would focus on hotspots and common routes used to enter the U.S. U.S. lawmakers have been debating the divisive new immigration bill. The Senate has approved a law that grants millions of illegal immigrants U.S. citizenship and calls for the creation of a guest worker program while beefing up border security. But in order to come into effect, the plan must be reconciled with a tougher anti-immigration measure passed by the House of Representatives that insists all illegal immigration should be criminalized. The issue has polarized politics in U.S. society. Right-wing groups have protested against the illegal immigrants, while millions of people marched in support of them last month.
And now, 11 minutes after 5 o'clock, it's time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Time to take another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky. Most of us rubes and common riffraff simply have no idea how difficult it is to be rich. The demands are crushing because one is always expected to live up to, well, expectations. Take the simple act of ordering a drink in a bar. I would take a stool and say, "Give me a beer." Or, on special occasions, "I feel like a nice Chardonnay tonight." If you are Mr. Richie Rich, however, you must show more discernment, refinement, savoir-faire, and, how shall I put it, wealth. Yeah, that's it, wealth. Luckily, the Reserve Club, a trendy spot in downtown Chicago, has come up with just the libation for the hoity-toity set to order. The Ruby Red. This is not a concoction made with ruby red grapefruit, as you and I might assume, but a delightful blend of Grey Goose vodka, hypnotique cognac, pomegranate liqueur, a splash of Dom Perignon champagne, and to top it off, a 1-carat grade A ruby. Yes, a real gem of a cocktail. You can enjoy a ruby red martini for only $950 per glass. The club manager who invented the Ruby Red says he was trying to come up with something for the elite clientele that would be more memorable than merely opening yet another bottle of expensive champagne. "We wanted to use pomegranate because it's hitting a popular trend with the antioxidants," he explained. "Dom Perignon champagne added a certain je ne sais quoi, while using the Grey Goose vodka brought a smooth and silky kick," he twittered. And, of course, the Ruby brought the wow factor into play, as well as bringing the price up. So far, he's sold 3 Ruby Reds, including one to a 20-something free spender who was out to impress a first date. This is Jim Hightower saying, the club also offers a Ruby-less Ruby Red for only $120. But that would be so, well, so common. He sold none of these. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Counterspin and independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, Bread and Roses. At 7, Jay's Place. Tonight's weather mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and lows in the low 50s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of rain in the afternoon and the highs in the low 70s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Last night, the BBC broadcasted footage from an incident in March in which U.S. soldiers were accused of executing 11 Iraqis, including 4 children. The U.S. military says it was hunting for an Al-Qaeda suspect. However, the Iraqi police maintain those U.S. soldiers rounded up and executed an entire family in a house, which they then demolished. FSRN's Aaron Glanz and Salam Talib report.
The BBC didn't broadcast all the tape in its possession, calling it too gruesome for television. But they said the video showed all 11 Iraqis killed, from a 75-year-old grandmother to a 6-month-old baby, were killed by bullet wounds to the head and stomach. Iraqi policemen told the network that after everyone was shot, the U.S. military bombed the house.
There are many, many, many stories, like Haditha, still undercover and need to be highlighted in Iraq.
Dr. Salam Ismail is projects manager for the organization Doctors for Iraq and former chief of the junior doctors in Baghdad's medical city. He was providing medical care in the western Iraqi city of Haditha when U.S. soldiers killed 24 Iraqis in their home last November. He says during the same assault, the U.S. military attacked the hospital and burned the pharmacy.
You can imagine the city of Haditha, especially in the hospital, have been attacked 3 times and destroyed the medical stores and all departments in it in one of these attacks and have been occupied. And also in November 2005 by the American and Iraqi army for 7 days, which is a severe breach of Geneva Conventions. In one of these attacks, the hospital had been sieged for 3 hours and end with using live ammunition inside it and handcuffing all doctors and destroying and burning the medical store, all with the content of medical store burned by this random shooting, and ending with killing one of the patients in his bed, and we have the name and age of that patient also.
In Baghdad Thursday, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told reporters violence against civilians by occupying troops is common in Iraq. He added, many soldiers have, quote, no respect for citizens, smashing civilian cars and killing on a suspicion or a hunch. At the Pentagon, Major General William Caldwell disagreed.
The coalition does not and it will not tolerate any unethical or criminal behavior. Any allegations of such activities will be fully investigated, and any members found to have committed these violations will be held accountable.
John Oliveira was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy and a spokesman for an aircraft carrier battle group until he resigned in disgust in 2004.
They're using the media to turn it into a justice issue, not a policy issue.
Oliveira says, as with most cases, the Bush administration first tried to ignore the allegations, then denied the acts occurred. When the evidence became overwhelming, the Pentagon promised a thorough investigation. He says it's the same spin as during the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, after which numerous low-ranking soldiers were put on trial, but the upper echelons of the Pentagon remained unscathed.
All of a sudden, the Pentagon has admitted there's issues, the administration has admitted there are issues, that they're going to get to the bottom of this. So now all of a sudden the administration is on the side of the Iraqis who said that this happened, and they need to lend some credibility with the American public that, hey, we are taking responsibility for this. We aren't hiding anything. What they're failing to mention is that they did hide this for several months. The administration is using this to get the picture away from them, the Pentagon, put it on the Marines, and put it on, especially on those young Marines that will almost guaranteed will be taken to trial. But I will almost guarantee that none of their leadership will be taken to trial, or at most they'll get a letter of reprimand and in their service records.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
In Chile, the government has issued a proposal in response to the demands of striking high school students. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garritón has the story.
More than 400 students from throughout Chile are meeting in an assembly to study the government response to their demands. On a national televised address to the nation last night, President Michelle Bachelet gave her government response to high school students who have been on strike for over 2 weeks. The government gave in to most of the students' demands. Bachelet said the government will issue a free national bus pass, pay for nearly all students to take university entrance exams, increase government subsidies to poor families, and create a broad commission to discuss changes to the Education Act so that it would guarantee their right to an education. After studying the government response, the students are expected to meet with the Minister of Education to let the government know if they accept the proposal or if they will continue negotiating on issues. If an agreement is not reached, the students have called for a national strike Monday. For FRSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
In Oaxaca, Mexico, Public school teachers are mobilizing against a package of education reforms that would privatize the public education system and drastically reduce the teaching of history to Mexican students. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
Mexican public school teachers have been on a strike for almost 2 weeks. Tens of thousands of teachers have completely occupied the state capital of Oaxaca, setting up tents and sleeping in the streets and plazas of the city center. During a massive march today, at least 50,000 teachers and their allies demanded greater resources for public education from the state and federal governments. Although the teachers receive support from campesino groups, indigenous organizations, and other activists, their mobilizations are opposed by business leaders, local politicians, and most mainstream media. This morning, political leaders issued an ultimatum to the teachers to either abandon their occupation of the city center or face eviction by security forces. Vladimir Flores, Oaxaca City, Free Speech Radio News.
Armed men have kidnapped eight Western oil workers in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. FSRN Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
Six of the kidnapped oil workers are from Britain, while the other two are from the United States and Canada. About 40 gunmen in boats kidnapped the oil workers early Friday morning at an offshore oil rig near the Nigerian coast. The rig is operated by Fred Olsen Energy, a Norwegian oil company. A presidential spokesman says the kidnapping is the result of a disagreement between local communities and the oil company. In recent months, there has been growing anger in local communities in the Niger Delta against Western oil companies operating in the region. Local communities accuse Western oil companies of polluting their land and denying them a share of the billions of dollars made yearly from oil sales. The growing anger has culminated in the abduction of foreign oil workers. This is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
20 years after the explosion at the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl in the Ukraine, the legal fallout has just reached France. Professor Pierre Pellerin, who was the head of France's nuclear safety watchdog 20 years ago, has been formally accused of deliberately concealing the seriousness of contamination of parts of the French countryside from the French people. An investigation is continuing into the responsibilities of politicians in the alleged cover-up, including the role of Jacques Chirac, who was the prime minister. However, for the time being, anti-nuclear campaigners and a group of 500 thyroid cancer sufferers are celebrating a first victory in a marathon legal campaign. Professor Pellerin, now 82, has been placed under formal investigation for aggravated deception and a potentially more serious accusation of causing involuntary bodily harm was dropped on Wednesday. At the time of the explosion at the Chernobyl reactor, the 26th of April 1986, the professor was head of the agency, part of the health ministry, which reported on risks to health. Campaigners have long protested that this deliberately concealed the fact that there were pockets of contamination from high rainfall as the Chernobyl cloud moved backwards. That's the Cable Evening News for Friday, June 2nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and you can leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@cable.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on Translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kabu.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Lisa Loving and Noah Eaton, who is also tonight's audio editor. Tonight's AP sleuth is Jacob Venstein. And special thanks to reporter Jacob Venstein and our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 2nd of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A surprise visit from a well-known celebrity delighted the Navajo Nation this week. As KSUT's Jones Whistler tells us, television talk show host Oprah Winfrey visited the Navajo Nation in Arizona Wednesday to gather footage for a future Native American segment for her program.
About 450 Navajo, Hopi, and others were present, although right up to the last minute, Navajo Nation President Joe Shirley Jr. said Harpo Productions quelled rumors Oprah would attend.
First, we had heard that she was going to be here, and then we had heard that she had called, she's not coming. And then the next thing we know, she's here, Oprah's here, get over there. So we got over there. It's a real nice surprise.
President Shirley hurried from a meeting to greet Winfrey and escort her through the crowds of exuberant fans, production crews, and security personnel. She toured the sacred Window Rock, attended a blessing of the Navajo Veterans Park, and watched children perform a powwow dance.
I thought it was a real honor to have such a celebrity grace us with her presence, especially on sacred grounds like right underneath Window Rock. She's a philanthropist. We're doing everything we can to try to get some help for our detention facilities, especially in Western Navajo at Tuba City.
Decades-old detention facilities in Tuba City, Arizona, are closing because of poor structural conditions, forcing criminals to be moved to other detention facilities in Arizona and New Mexico or back out onto the streets. Jails were not discussed during Winfrey's sojourn in Window Rock, but her visit was prompted by an email from Priscilla Lightfoot, the Tuba City chapter coordinator, who is actively working to get temporary facilities built there. In Colorado, I'm Jones Whistler.
Republicans in the Wisconsin Assembly have failed to override the state's governor on a plan that would have given the legislature more oversight of off-reservation tribal gaming compacts. Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The Assembly's vote means Governor Jim Doyle and future Wisconsin governors will retain their authority to negotiate off-reservation gaming pacts. They'll also need approval from the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs, but they won't need to check with the legislature. Republican Assembly Speaker John Gard says that's fundamentally unfair, and tried to convince his colleagues that they should want a place at the negotiating table.
Casinos, gambling, all the stuff that goes with it needs as many checks and balances in the political process as humanly possible.
Critics of this plan worried it would potentially slow or even halt some off-reservation casino plans already in the works. Democrat Dale Travis says that's because it would be nearly impossible to get 132 lawmakers to negotiate a gaming compact. He thinks it's best left up to governors. Different tribes lobbied hard on both sides of this issue. The Potawatomi, which operate a major casino in Milwaukee, ran radio ads urging lawmakers to vote for more oversight. As it stands now, they face potential competition from an off-reservation casino being planned by the Menominee in Kenosha, Wisconsin. In Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Sean Johnson.
Two California tribes have announced their community giving for the second quarter of the year. Both tribes own profitable Sacramento area casinos and give about $1 million a year to local nonprofits. Ellen Churchak reports from Sacramento.
The United Auburn Indian community gave out about $175,000 this second quarter to charities like the Salvation Army. Tribal Chairwoman Jessica Tavares says tribe members remember when they were poor before they had a casino.
Now we've been blessed with something that can help all our tribal members, and they feel it's important that we give back.
The Rumsey Band of Winton Indians donated about $200,000 to charities. Leland Kenter, community fund member, says the tribe wants to be accepted as a good neighbor.
If you're able to be a part of the community and participate with the community, then you know you're a better part of it.
The Rumsey Band has given more than $8 million to local charities since shortly after its casino opened in 1999. I'm Ellen Churchak in Sacramento.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.com www.independentnativenews.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.